It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Healthcare is a hot issue in the U.S. Senate race between Democratic incumbent Bob Casey and his Republican challenger, Congressman Lou Barletta. WITF's Brett Schultes reports the two are clashing over health coverage of pre-existing conditions and the future of the Affordable Care Act.
So I called him, I said, I think I should talk to my wife first.
At an Italian restaurant in Scranton, Republican Congressman Lou Barletta is speaking to a crowd of supporters.
I didn't announce the next day.
Barletta is challenging Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Bob Casey Jr.
When we finally had a chance to repeal and replace Obamacare, John McCain had voted no, and we lost by one vote. And I thought to myself, if I were there instead of Bob Casey, Obamacare would be gone today. How many more times? How many more times in our country now?
For Barletta, who says he was encouraged to run by President Donald Trump, dismantling the Affordable Care Act is one cornerstone of a platform closely allied with the president.
Small business confidence is at an all-time high. Consumer confidence is at an all-time high. There are actually more jobs now than people who are unemployed. The economy is so good under Donald Trump that even Colin Kaepernick found a job.
To Barletta, like many of his supporters, a conversation about health care is a conversation about costs.
In Pennsylvania, we saw our premiums go up 120%. And your deductible is so high that people stop going to the doctor. They can't afford to pay them the deductible, so they don't even have health insurance anymore.
That number is slightly off. Aggregate ACA premiums went up 114% since 2014, according to the Pennsylvania Department of Insurance. But Barletta's point stands as he speaks to one of the two aspects of the ACA that have made it a complex issue for Republicans and Democrats alike. On one hand, even some Democrats have shown unease with the cost of the plans, especially since the individual mandate required people to get insurance or pay a tax. On the other hand, even some Republicans have been uneasy about losing the protection for pre-existing conditions under the ACA.
Our twin daughters were four when they got sick. There are no words to describe the terror we felt when doctors said they both had cancer.
It's that second point that has Senator Casey on the offensive.
But if Lou Barletta has his way, kids like mine could be denied the care they need. In Congress, Barletta voted to let insurance companies strip coverage for pre-existing conditions.
The two campaigns tangled over the ad, with Barletta saying it was a personal attack coming after he learned his 18-month-old grandson has cancer. Casey's campaign noted they've profiled that same family for years. But to Casey's point, Barletta, like most Republicans, did vote to repeal the ACA. That move would have nixed protections for pre-existing conditions, although, in theory, Republicans might have reintroduced those protections as part of the replace Obamacare effort. Casey didn't have any campaign stops planned, but he was available for a phone interview. He says the vote to repeal the ACA was just the beginning of Republican efforts to return health insurance to the days when an illness could keep people from getting covered.
And then the second thing they did was ram through this tax bill, which not only gave the top 1% 83% of the benefits and gave big corporations $2 trillion in permanent tax relief, but guess what? In that tax bill, guess what it had? You guessed it probably. It had a cut to health care by getting rid of the so-called individual mandate, thereby ripping away health care from millions of people. So
Casey says that move paved the way for Republicans to file a lawsuit in September in federal court.
5.3 million people, almost half our population, have a pre-existing condition. If you're worried about those protections, you should be really worried about voting for my opponent or other Republicans. It is now the official position of the Republican Party that pre-existing condition protections do not matter, and they're ready to take those away because they're all supporting this lawsuit in Texas.
That lawsuit, Texas versus United States, asserts the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional and therefore should be thrown out.
And if you get rid of the whole thing, then you get rid of things like the banning of denying care for pre-existing conditions, right?
That's Dan Mallinson, assistant professor of public policy and administration at Penn State Harrisburg.
It's been a difficult environment to actually reform the Affordable Care Act when the position is that we need to get rid of it. So I don't know that the Democrats have made a lot of good, strong argument to reform. They've just been sort of fighting the repeal battle.
Mallinson says while Republicans don't want to be on the hook for rolling back protection for pre-existing conditions, Democrats are still dealing with the issue of high premiums and deductibles, a problem they haven't quite been able to fix.
You know, as they went through the process of trying to repeal and replace, they couldn't really get replace done, and then there was some effort to just repeal. But if you just repeal, you not only get rid of the things that people don't like the individual mandate, you get rid of other things that people do like the pre-existing conditions clause. And if you can't replace that with anything, then you know you may be able to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but you lose those things that are potentially popular even among Republicans.
Barletta is fighting his own battle, and despite the energy of supporters in places like Scranton, it's an uphill one. Casey has raised $2.2 million in the third quarter of the campaign and has $6.7 million available. Barletta also raised $2.2 million, but has just $1.3 million to spend. Recent independent polls show Casey with a more than 15-point lead. In Scranton, Lackawanna County, I'm Brett Schultes.
There could very well be an influx of young voters casting ballots in all sorts of races November 6th. Ryan Dito's senior writer for City Paper, who's been reporting a big increase in the registration of 18 to 29-year-olds in Pennsylvania. Ryan, welcome.
Hello there.
So how big of an increase, and how does Pennsylvania compare to other states?
So there was a report that came out by Target Smart, which is a Democratic data firm, and they showed that Pennsylvania actually had a 16% increase in voter registration among 18 to 29-year-olds, and that was the largest in the entire country, and it's actually well above any other state. Rhode Island was next with about 11%. So, Pennsylvania is probably the leader in terms of getting young people registered to vote.
Did these numbers reflect all registration, not necessarily one party or another?
Yeah, these were done in bipartisan manner, so this is whatever party or no party.
You reported a big jump in registration of young adults in the 17th and 18th congressional districts specifically. Do we know why?
I would say that the advocacy group that is doing the registration would say that it's their efforts. That's Next Gen America, which is run by that liberal billionaire Tom Steyer, and they've done a lot of work in college campuses all across the state, and specifically in Western Pennsylvania. And they said that Pitt was one of the biggest they had in all of the state. I think Pitt came in second, just behind Penn State. So I think there's a lot of students at Pitt that wanted to register in Pittsburgh, basically.
Ryan, did you get a sense of why the young people are registering?
Well, what was told to me was they healthcare is a big issue for them, and they are kind of worried coming out of college that they won't be able to afford healthcare and won't be able to afford their student debt, and I think that's been a pretty powerful driving force, I think, among all voters, but I guess it also is sticking with the young voters as well.
So we'll just have to wait and see if the newly registered young voters actually show up at the polls?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the question everyone's waiting for. But I know that the advocacy group also does a Get Out to Vote text, and I think they've sent thousands of those to the 6,500 new registered Pennsylvanian voters in the 17th and 18th district.
Ryan Dito is senior writer for Pittsburgh City Paper. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA. Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A librarian and bookseller will go to trial for allegedly stealing $8 million worth of rare books and artifacts. The manager of the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's Rare Book Room, as well as a nearby bookshop owner, were charged in July. And space lovers will get a show this weekend. The annual Orionid meteor shower will streak across the night sky Sunday into Monday morning when it peaks. The Orionids get their name from the constellation Orion, where the meteors appear to come from. Get more top news by signing up for our newsletter at wesa.fm/inboxedition.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The last time the administration of the Pittsburgh Public Schools tinkered with the map that assigns kids to schools based on where they live was in 2011. But where kids go to school today and why has a much longer history. As part of our series, Dividing Lines, 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed reports on the biggest driver of the changes to the school feeder pattern over the last 50 years, desegregation.
It was February 1968. Mild weather saw chunks of ice float down the Allegheny River to the Ohio, assuaging fears of a flood. Coal workers in Somerset County were on strike. The U.S. minimum wage had just gone up to $1.60 an hour. And on February 2nd, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission ordered Pittsburgh Public Schools to desegregate. Segregation in education had been illegal in Pennsylvania since 1881, says Ralph Proctor, professor of ethnic and diversity studies at the Community College of Allegheny County.
With that integration, black kids still went in segregated school because the neighborhoods are segregated.
The district's initial desegregation plan was rejected by the commission as showing a lack of commitment. So the school board began exploring the idea of busing. Some black children had already been bused to white schools due to overcrowding, but busing white children to black schools for the sake of integration was a step too far for many parents.
When that was even suggested, white parents went bonkers. They were going to remove their kids from the school system. They were going to sue. They were going to write their congressman.
By 1976, several plans had been submitted and rejected, and the Human Relations Commission sought a court order to force the district to desegregate. But that year, a key change took place on the board that would make achieving the state standard for, quote, racial balance even more difficult. Meet the district's longest-serving board member of the last half century, Gene Fink.
I ran on a neighborhood schools ticket.
Before 1976, the members of the school board were appointed by judges. Fink says they were largely elites, out of touch with real Pittsburgh families.
So we banded together and we said, we need an elected school board. And then the busing came up, and then we really needed an elected school board.
Fink says it wasn't about black or white. She just didn't want to see kids picked up out of their neighborhoods and dropped somewhere else to go to school. It was artificial, unnatural, she says. Evelyn Neiser was an appointed school board member who kept her seat on the newly elected board. She says the district held regular meetings about how to achieve desegregation.
Sometimes we were there till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning listening to parents say why we shouldn't desegregate the schools.
Finally, in 1980, a comprehensive desegregation plan passed the school board. It was a narrow victory, with 5 board members, including Fink and Neiser, voting for it. Frances Vitti was one of the 4 members who cast a no vote. She says the plan put too much of a burden on black students.
I remember meeting with some black families, and they said, "Do you think our children were born with wheels?"
The state commission again rejected the district's plan, but despite that, the district went ahead with it. Mayor Caligiuri pleaded for calm in the days leading up to the start of the school year. On September 2, 1980, a quarter of the district's 46,000 students went to schools outside their neighborhoods. Greenfield Elementary, for example, was supposed to go from mostly white to half white and half black with the addition of children from Homewood. But so many white parents pulled their kids from the school that Greenfield ended up 3/4 black. This was happening all over the city, and that's how the desegregation plan ended up perpetuating the problem it was meant to solve.
Busing was a temporary bad solution that was a Band-Aid on a problem that needed major surgery.
When Thurgood Marshall argued Brown versus Board of Education in front of the Supreme Court, he presented desegregation as a means to an end, a way for black children to receive the same quality of education as white children. But in the decades following the state order, desegregation in education became an end in and of itself in Pittsburgh. Newspaper articles from the period reveal a school system almost obsessively fixated on the racial makeup of every school. Still out of compliance, the board tried again in the mid-90s to craft a plan that was mutually acceptable to both the public and the Human Relations Commission. But when 800 people showed up to a public hearing at Schenley High School, it became clear that this would not be a kumbaya moment. Eugene Beard was with the local chapter of the NAACP at the time.
And I mean, it was a battle royal.
Many white parents argued in favor of a return to neighborhood schools. Many black parents called that a resegregation.
Even giving them the benefit of the doubt. You know, a lot of parents just wanted their kids to be closer to home. Black parents would have liked that too. But the issue was, where was going to be the best education?
Valerie McDonald Roberts was on city council at the time, but had formerly served on the school board. She says an end to busing would have been a step backwards toward inequity.
Let's face it, that's why there was the busing, is for black children to go to the quote-unquote better schools, not necessarily because there were white children there. It was because the resources were in the white schools. They were not in the black schools.
Meanwhile, in Harrisburg, the legislature passed a bill to prevent the Human Relations Commission from requiring districts to bus students for the sake of integration. Just like that, the era of desegregation in Pittsburgh public schools was over. And here's the kicker. In the 3 decades since the state order to desegregate, the school district never actually did it. Tracy Reed Armont is a Pittsburgh Public Schools parent and is on the board of education advocacy group A-plus Schools. She wrote her dissertation on desegregation in the district and says school leaders were trying to solve for the wrong problem. The real issue?
Racism. We don't solve for racial balance. We don't solve for adequate resources. If we just solved for racism, if that became the central thing that we solved for, then we would at least get at what the real problem is. Like, if we could all just say that black and brown children are not inherently less able.
That their circumstances are not of their own making, or their parents' making, or their grandparents' making, but are based on an established set of practices that kept the city and the schools segregated. White parents participated in that. Today, the racial makeup of schools is no longer front of mind for the district. Diversity is important, says Superintendent Anthony Hamlet, but making all schools good schools is paramount.
So you don't have to pick, I want to go to Colfax. If not, I'm going to a charter school or I'm going to a private school. Now you have a plethora of choices because you're going to get the same standard of high expectations, rigorous coursework, and you know, a supportive environment in any of our schools.
The district might revisit its feeder pattern soon, pending the results of a year-long study of student demographics and enrollment projections. Hamlet says he believes the study will reveal that students, both black and white, are coming back to the district. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
You can find out more about the Dividing Lines series at wesa.fm/dividinglines. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5. I'm Kevin Gavin.
And I'm Megan Harris. After several reports of stalking in Lawrenceville this summer, several groups came together to host a workshop explaining how bystanders can help curb harassment and assault. A few of the organizers are with us in studio today. Dave Bringen is the executive director of Lawrenceville United. Rachel Weber is the business district program coordinator for Lawrenceville Corporation. And Will McGinnis is the supervisor of prevention at Pittsburgh Action Against Rape. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The training happened earlier this month. What was happening in the neighborhood that you felt bystander training was necessary?
It really came out of some public reports on some of our local social media sites about multiple women reporting harassment or stalking by someone in the neighborhood. So we had kind of intervened after hearing about this. I mean, one of the women was very brave and in reporting this publicly and finding out about other women who are being targeted by the same individual. So we started working with some of these women to try to resolve some of those issues with the police. But there was this large community interest around it because, you know, this had been so public. So we wanted to give the neighborhood a chance to intervene and to give them some tools to actually address this as a community.
Will, Rachel?
Yeah, it was definitely a big part of our business district. Lawrenceville actually has the largest concentration of female-owned businesses in Western Pennsylvania. So there's already sort of that network in place for women who own businesses in the neighborhood. And it was just sort of a next natural step for them to come together to create a solution for this.
In the early going or within the training itself, were the Pittsburgh police able to contribute?
Yes. I mean, they were very involved in the specific incidents with the women who were targeted, and they really stepped up big, I think, and were very involved in this. But and were one of the drivers for why we had the bystander intervention training, because we were hearing from some neighbors some ways that they wanted to intervene that were not so great. It came from a good place, but. So the police really encouraged us to think about how can we actually train people to step in a productive way, in a way that protects safety.
So you see that the need is there. The Lawrenceville United, Lawrenceville Corporation are representing the neighborhood. How did Pittsburgh Action Against Rape get involved, and how did the training come to be?
Yeah, sure. Dave reached out to us sort of about really to kind of get like victim services. He wanted to sort of see like how he could make sure he supported the victims in this case. So we started talking, and sort of I gave him some other services out there that he can go to. I recommended Women's Law Project to kind of really think about how the victims can get services around making sure their legal needs are happening. And then I also connected him to some of our advocates as well. So from there, I think the conversation started coming, and I actually sent him off, and he came back to me and asked, because I think Sue Fritchie from the Women's Law Project actually said.
A good friend of the show.
Yeah, she's great. She said that, hey, PAR has a bystander intervention program. Why don't you go back out and reach out to them? So that's what happened.
And PAR has several kind of a la carte, I don't know if I'm saying that right, programs for trainings in various capacities, crisis intervention and other things. Mm-hmm. Did you customize this specifically for a neighborhood group?
Yeah, absolutely. So every one of our programs are really customizable. I mean, we really try to fit the need of the community, the group, the university. Across the board, a lot of the bystander intervention trainings we do are on universities and sometimes with schools as well. But so this time is really sort of interesting for us because I know myself included haven't had the opportunity to really do any work in sort of a larger community aspect. So I thought it was really important to tailor it because, I mean, A, they have different needs. There's and in many ways it is a vulnerable space. Not everybody knows everybody in the room. So we want to make sure that we tailored it so that everybody in there got something out of it and really started the conversation like around how do we even think about stepping in or saying something or responding to if an act of violence is occurring.
A few hundred people signed up as interested on the Facebook event page advertising the training. How many people ultimately came, and what was the reaction that you had in the room?
We had about 60 people actually show up, which was really great. And it was sort of a good mix of both residents and business owners and visitors of the neighborhood. And I think everyone was just really happy to be in a space where we could talk about this openly, safely, and productively.
The early RSVPs were overwhelmingly female. Did many men attend?
There were men in the room. And actually, a lot of the men that came with their partner or in some cases with like a mom even. Which was interesting. We saw a lot of people coming kind of as a family unit and addressing this together. I mean, at the table that I was at, for instance, there was a whole family there that was kind of engaging in this conversation together, which, you know, was really interesting and pretty meaningful, I think.
Why is it important to have something approaching gender parity in something like a group bystander intervention training?
Oh, I think it's critical that there's that there has to be representation from all genders, all people. The reality is, sexual violence happens to everybody from youth to, you know, the elderly. I mean, the real reason is that, and also too, if men aren't involved, then like it's not gonna grow. People aren't gonna be able to like feel like they can step in. If it just sits in like in some sort of, I think for a while people talked about it as a women's issue, which is not real. I mean, it's a community issue. It's a people issue. And I think if men aren't involved in that and we don't start stepping up and getting involved and having conversations that are real, that then it's just the prevention isn't going to grow, if that makes sense.
And it's important for men to be aware of what women deal with on a daily basis. I think that was one of the things that I saw in the room was for men who live in the neighborhood, they have a very different experience. To hear that, you know, women experience catcalling on a daily basis in the neighborhood, that was eye-opening, I think, for some folks. And mm-hmm. you know, understanding that your experience as a man in the neighborhood can be radically different from what other identities experience walking down the street.
I think it's important, too, with male business owners. You know, a lot of them will come to me and say, like, my space isn't seen as safe to some people. You know, what can I do to fix that? And personally, there are spaces in Pittsburgh that I, like, can't or won't go to for those reasons. So I think it's really good that a lot of our business owners are sort of making an effort to try and make their spaces as safe as possible for everyone also.
In terms of designing a training and creating this safe space, how do you create a conversation that doesn't put too much of the mental load on women to share their experiences in a way that men can understand what's going on?
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time before a training thinking about space, right? How we create a safe space for people. The reality is these trainings aren't really set up to, and I think we make a point of it to make sure that we not only have advocates in the room that if something does occur, if somebody needs, if they disclose or they're feeling triggered or they're feeling overwhelmed, they can step out and have like a talk with somebody one-on-one. We make sure our service is there. We try to incorporate some, in a perfect world, we try to incorporate some breaks in there where people can kind of have that. But also, oddly enough, I feel like the way we try to structure it is so that everybody has a voice there. And I feel like the load isn't always on women there. And maybe it's just natural. Like, I mean, it might be a man thing, but I feel like men want to talk and I think they want to help. And I think they want to jump in and be a part of it. So I think we really try to make sure that people aren't in a space that's unsafe and all the weight doesn't come on them to share their experiences. A lot of what we do is we have scenario-based, the way we take it out of that. We're really not there to hear their experiences. Obviously, they come up, and obviously we deal with that when it happens. But in those spaces, we try to make it safe by making sure that they have sort of – they're removed from something that might be their own experiences.
And I think PAR did a really good job of having counselors on hand during the training, a separate room that folks could go to if it started to get too emotional or they needed to take a break. And then they were extremely intentional along with our co-facilitator, Heather Manning, and really setting up some community agreements at the start of it so we could kind of ground some of that conversation and with some expectations and really making sure that we're thinking about the intersection, too, of sexual violence and other forms of harassment.
And the reality is, I mean, it can be a heavy, heavy room, and I think it was a heavy room at times. But I think, I was really grateful for Heather Manning to kind of help us at the end. She really grounded. She did some grounding exercises with us and allowed sort of the space to end on a positive note, at least. So
I think, too, it was a safe space for people to say when they thought a comment wasn't helpful or when a comment was sort of triggering to them. And there are definitely instances where mm-hmm. people spoke up and said, hey, you know, let's reword this so it's a more productive conversation.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking with three of the organizers behind a recent bystander intervention training held in Lawrenceville this month. They'll be back with us here in a moment. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Earlier this month, a string of incidents in Lawrenceville prompted a couple neighborhood groups to partner together with Pittsburgh Action Against Rape. They offered a bystander training event to teach people what they do when they witness sexual harassment. Remaining with us is Lawrenceville Corporation's Rachel Weber, who helped organize the event, Dave Bringen, Executive Director of Lawrenceville United, and Will McGinnis with Pittsburgh Action Against Rape. Some of the promotional materials online for the training itself mention not just Lawrenceville residents, but also business owners and other neighborhood residents nearby Lawrenceville or across Pittsburgh. How important are small business owners specifically in preventing harassment and abuse?
I think very important. You know, they're the ones that are sort of particularly nightlife businesses. They're the ones that see this on a daily basis. And we've been very lucky to also have PAR as a partner with those businesses. PAR has a program called Project Last Call that goes into restaurants and bars and a few of our neighborhood restaurants and bars that have been a participant in that program. But we were also lucky to have all sorts of types of business owners at that training, whether it was retail or coffee shops or what have you. And actually, a business owner that had experienced this harassment was part of this training and was very public with that and was actually offered up the space. But we needed to switch because we had so much interest.
Whether it's bystander intervention or something like Project Last Call, the training itself was offered for the general public. What sort of techniques, if you can elaborate a little bit, does it recommend?
Sure. So I think we kind of balance it between some informational, like, because I think the reality is in my work, you know, I tend to think that everybody understands that sexual violence is a gamut of behaviors, and that it really is not just touch behaviors. It really happens from, you know, these sort of non-touch catcallings clear up into sexual assault and violence, right? I think we try to do some informational skills with that and just kind of get them on board with us. And then we also try to really make sure that there's room for them to talk a lot. And really, I think the most that we try to do is make sure nobody has space to talk about this. Nobody's like sitting around the house like, oh, let's talk about how if we sit down and we sit down today at a restaurant, we see something happening, how are we going to handle that? So I think the techniques that we try to use is to set up a real conversation for people to practice the skills needed to intervene and get over barriers, right? Because that's really, I think most people want to stand up and do something to help people. But the reality is there's these certain barriers that exist that nobody will get around, be it social credit, be it fear. And if you're with your friends, it's even worse, right? Because nobody wants to be embarrassed in front of their friends. Once if I did something wrong, once if I make the situation worse. So I think what we try to do is make sure that we acknowledge those barriers are real. And like, these are real things that will stop you from helping people. And then how do we get past that? So a lot of it is having people structure conversations where people have a chance to talk about it. And then we share some skill sets, like how, if you can't intervene because you're afraid, right? How else can you do it? Okay, well, maybe you can help somebody afterwards. Maybe you can delegate the responsibility out and have a like the bar owner or the restaurant manager or somebody help.
So. How do you accommodate that practicing? Is it through conversation? Is it through role-playing of some kind without triggering your audience, of course?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think it's a reality that, I mean, unfortunately, there will be a lot of times where people are triggered. We know that sexual violence is pervasive. So chances are people in the room are not only victims of sexual violence, but also possibly perpetrators of sexual violence as well. So I think it's hard not to. And I think we don't set out to trigger people, but I'm sure it happens. So a lot of it is role-playing, not one-on-one role-playing. Like nobody – I never ask somebody to be a victim, or I never ask somebody to be a perpetrator. That's something we wouldn't do because that could be very triggering. But one of the things we do is we set up conversations as if you saw something. Like how would I respond to my neighbor? How would I have a conversation with them? Hey, I saw something here last night. It really bothered me. How do we talk about that? And then in the moment, like how would I respond? So –
And I know at my table, some of those scenarios, there were lived experiences from some of the women at my table, very similar types of situations to the scenarios that Par was outlining. So that for the rest of us at the table, I mean, that really illustrates the stakes of these situations. And I think, it reiterates the importance of doing something in that moment, because these are real. You know, these aren't just theoretical scenarios. These are lived experiences that women are having on a daily basis, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that was one of the, I think, a benefit of working with Dave is he was able to, I think Rachel and Dave were able to say, here are the complaints we have in the neighborhood. And like, so I tried to make sure we brought similar things that were happening, right? Because we wanted to just come out with something that they couldn't experience or they couldn't like connect to, because then no work would be done. So
in this case, those conversations were based on real incidents or simulations of those real incidents?
I would say, yeah.
Yeah, and I think even personally, I myself am a survivor of sexual assault, and even being a part of the planning of this training was sometimes a toll on me, honestly. And I think we really created a good space where people could, take a handle on it and feel like they were being productive rather than just sort of feeling isolated.
Great. To all of you, what's the importance of community involvement, getting everyone together in preventing violence?
I mean, this is a community issue. This is not, as Will said, this is not just a women's issue. This is not just a police issue, right? It is really about the entire community needs to step up in order to prevent some of to change our culture around these issues. So, I think our training was one step to really try to give folks some more tools to feel empowered to step up, because it really is incumbent on the entire community to stop sexual harassment.
And I think sometimes, our neighborhood is not always welcoming to all kinds of people. And I think this is a great first step to sort of be able, at least for me, to start those conversations with business owners so that they can actually make their safe spaces safe.
Yeah. And I think, having these conversations can't just be with professionals or with the police or with owners of businesses. I mean, real people, not that they're real people too, but I mean, you know, like all people need to start having these conversations, because the reality is like 90% of the time, those people are not around when a situation is occurring, right? So, and for the community to be involved in talking about on a daily basis, I think that will just, and it'll keep it fresh, right? And then people will be like, okay, well, if I see something happening, then I'll step up.
And in Lawrenceville, I think in particular, we have an ethos of kind of wanting to solve problems as a community. That's something we really value as a community organization. So it made a lot of sense to have this in Lawrenceville, where we've been doing a lot of organizing around public safety on a resident level for years.
For those who might be concerned, you know, obviously this is a first step, but is a training enough? What comes next?
No, it's not enough. And we said that I think at the start of the training that we're not going to solve sexual violence in a 2-hour training. Certainly not trying to set up the expectation for that. Also acknowledging that sexual harassment is not the only kinds of harassment that happens in our community. We've also heard reports of racial harassment, of harassment related to folks' religion. For the future, I think we want to continue the conversation. We want to have be focusing on some other forms of harassment that folks are experiencing in the neighborhood, and to continue the conversation and continue to reiterate some of these tools, because the reality is 1 2-hour training is not gonna solve this or give people all the tools they need. You need to exercise it as a muscle regularly.
Just a couple minutes left. When you're designing those trainings, whether it's for gender-based violence or race-based harassment, how do you make sure that you're including the voices of the people who not only need to hear these messages, but also want to feel comforted that their community is coming around them and does see the experience happening?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, we tried to be very intentional about including some of the women who were the target of that specific incidents of harassment and stalking in the neighborhood in the actual planning of the training. And I think it's important that you have folks with direct lived experience being at the table. And again, thinking about the intersection of identities too, that sexual harassment and racial harassment, there are intersections between those two things, and making sure that our facilitation and our planning team is cognizant of those things.
What can residents, final question, or visitors of Lawrenceville do if they are a victim or witness stalking, harassment, or assault in the neighborhood?
Absolutely. So always call the police, right? And if you are a victim of sexual violence, stalking, harassment, feel free to call. You can always reach out to PAR as well. We have a 24-hour helpline that operates 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that number is 1-866-END-RAPE. So once again, it's 1-866-END-RAPE. Feel free to call it. It's staffed, manned by advocates 24 hours a day. So even if it's late at night, feel free to call.
Folks can also reach out. Lawrenceville residents, you know, are welcome to reach out to us at Lawrenceville United too. We do a lot of liaising with Zone 2 police, and that can be a tough thing for folks to navigate. I know PAR does that as well. So that's something we're always willing to provide too.
Dave Bringen is the executive director of Lawrenceville United. Rachel Weber is the Business District Program Coordinator for Lawrenceville Corporation, and Will McGinnis is the Supervisor of Prevention at Pittsburgh Action Against Rape. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much.
I'm Megan Harris.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, ending the school-to-prison pipeline, where kids get in trouble at school and they're on a path toward incarceration, is the focus of a major production at City Theater. We'll talk with the director and an education advocate. Plus, what was the legislative stumbling block in allowing retroactive lawsuits in the clergy abuse scandal? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.
I'm Peter Sagal. Elizabeth Warren got in trouble for saying she had Native ancestry. And then she got in more trouble when she said